भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं चैव मदीरये नस्तपृष्वपदेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भागवत्युत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth canto, 25th chapter, text 54 and 53 and 54. I'll read 53 quietly, then we'll go to 54 for the group chanting.
Nirita nama paschatvas. Nirita nama paschatvas. Tayayati puranjana, vaisasam nam vishayam. Lubdakena samanvita, lubdakena samanvita.
Niriti, in of the name Niriti, nama, call, paschat, western, dva, gate, paya, by which yati used to go, puranjana, king puranjana, vaisasam, of the name vaisasa, nama, call, vishayam, to the place, lubdakena, of the friend named lubdaka. Samrita, samamrita, accompanied. Another gate on the western side was known as Niriti. Puranjana used to go through this gate to the place known as Vyavasa, or Vaisasa, accompanied by his friend Lubdaka. So I'll come back and read the verse again in the purport after we chant this verse that's on the board, 54. Anda amisam puranam, anta amisam puranam, nirva pesas krita ubhau ubhau, nirva pesas krita ubhau. Aksan vatam adipatis, aksan vatam adipatis, tabyam yati karoti cha, tabyam yati karoti cha, antavami samparo. Akshan vatam adipatis, tabhyam yati karoti kacha.
Thank you.
Pandav, blind. Amisam, among those. Puranam, of the inhabitants. Nirvak, of the name Nirvak. Pitaskritau, of the name Pitaskrit. Ubao, both of them. Akshanbatam, of the people who possessed eyes. Adipati, ruler. Tabyam, with both of them. Yati, used to go. Karoti, used to act. Cha, and. Of the many inhabitants of this city, there are two persons named Nirvak and Pisaskrit. Although King Puranjana was the ruler of the citizens who possessed eyes, he unfortunately used to associate with these blind men. Accompanied by them, he used to go here and there and perform various activities. We'll go back to the first verse, read the translation and the purport. Another gate on the western side was known as Niriti. Puranjan used to go through this gate to the place known as Vyasas, accompanied by his friend, Lubdaka. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This is a reference to the rectum. The rectum is supposed to be situated on the western side of the eyes, ears, and nose and ears. This gate is especially meant for death. When an ordinary living entity abandons his present body, he passes through the rectum. It is therefore painful. When one is called by nature to evacuate, one also experiences pain. The friend of the living entity who accompanies him through this gate is named Lubdaka, which means greed. Due to our greed, we eat unnecessarily, and such gluttony causes pain at the time of evacuation. The conclusion is that the living entity feels well if he evacuates properly. This gate is known as Niriti, or the painful gate. Om Agyanati Mirandusya Kiranjana Shlakaya Chaksura Militam Yena Tashmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, the rectum, the anus, or the asshole, or the butthole, it's sometimes referred to, and is like an opinion. Everyone has one, they say. Everyone has opinion. Just as many of our opinions are painful to others, so the rectum, Niriti, is painful to us. I hope these words don't offend anyone, but we're talking about holes, are we not? When I was teaching fractions to a fifth grade class at Simmons years ago, the children were practically hysterical when I used the word whole, meaning an entirety, a complete unit of something, a whole apple, a whole house, a whole bag of grains. Being immature, they were for some reason determined to substitute the word whole, H-O-L-E. It's best not to have our consciousness fixed on holes. And so I'm sure now the children that are coming up are much more mature, but still I think there's some squeamishness when we talk about holes. It's a fact. Some people think the holes in the body is beautiful. The eyes are beautiful on some people. The mouth is considered beautiful if it has full lips. But the anus is not considered a very beautiful hole, except by a certain class of men. Some men think it's very nice. Nonetheless, we are all proud of our holes. Proud that we can see, proud that we can smell, proud that we can speak and taste and hear and even evacuate. We're so proud of our bodies. We have bodies, with nice bodies, with nice holes. Aren't we something? Aren't we something else? Actually, we are something else. We're spirit souls. And this body should be thought of as an incumbency, a worthless shell to be cleaned and polished only as necessary. It is not a pleasure vehicle. It's not an RV. In America, they have RVs, recreational vehicles. We can live in it, like one can live in an RV, but it is not meant simply for recreation. It is meant for self-realization. Prabhupada says in the purport, due to our greed, we eat unnecessarily, and such gluttony causes pain at the time of evacuation. Conclusion is that living as he feels well if he evacuates properly. This gate is known as nirviti, or the painful gate. Today in America, they're selling stool softeners. We don't need those here in India, that's nice. But they're advertised on TV by smiling middle-aged ladies who appear vibrantly confident that their next trip to the toilet will be a painless one. But this is the concern of the common, ordinary person. This is his concern. Let us enjoy, let us soften our stool, let us make all kinds of arrangements for our comfort. These softeners to ease the passing of solid excrement waves from the body are but another of the endless array of useless medicines. While science refuses to cure cancer or heart disease, they are keen to find money-making gimmicks that promise you more comfort than you've ever known before on the toilet, in the WC, or in the restroom. In India, fortunately or unfortunately, we don't need stool softeners. But rather than curb gluttony by selling healthy foods, these people, they process packaged foods and sell in restaurants foods with highly dangerous levels of impure substances. The carcinogens, the poisons in a hamburger sold by McDonald's, are astronomical. They're horrifying. People are eating these things and thinking this is healthy, this is happy meal. But unfortunately, they're simply paving their way to hell, both physically, in terms of what it does to their body, and also spiritually, in terms of what it does to their karmic reactions. Thus, not only do the greedy eat too much, but they also literally eat the greed, the lubdaka of the manufacturers offering the so-called comfort foods. People are very, very greedy to make money. And they'll sell anything. There's an organization in America called the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And countless times they've found that these people have been bribed. They've been bribed by different industrial giants to allow unhealthy things to take place, unhealthy things to go onto the market. The Food and Drug Administration is supposed to analyze and see, are these things that are coming out of this company, are they... They're supposed to inspect them and analyze them and tell whether or not these are helpful, beneficial. But they don't care for that. They simply care for signing a piece of paper, taking a bribe and signing a piece of paper. So this is not God consciousness in any way, shape, or form. It is simply greed. The Labdaka, it sounds like a trade name, doesn't it, for some kind of big corporate giant or something. This gate, this niriti, is specially meant for death. When an ordinary living entity abandons his present body, he passes through the rectum. It is therefore painful. And when one is called by nature to evacuate, one also experiences pain. Someone pointed out to me once that the sheets and mattresses in the dying wards of hospitals are often stained and literally burned away by the part underneath where the buttocks rests. This is not a fortunate way to leave the body. People are leaving the body through the rectum. It's a very distressful thing. But it seems appropriate for sinful persons. Those Srila Prabhupada refers to as ordinary take this exit. A more advanced person, pious persons, are generally expected to leave through the mouth. And very advanced yogis leave through the top of the head, the Brahmarandam. But that's a tough act to follow in this time, day and time. It's pretty hard for us to imagine doing that. Our business, of course, as was pointed out the other day, is not to worry about how we're going to depart from this body. Our business is simply, while we're alive, while we're conscious, to be Krishna conscious. Think about the Supreme Lord, offer ourselves to Him. That is the proper use of this body and mind. There's a little more about that in the next verse. I'll read the translation again. Of the many inhabitants of this city, there are two persons named Nirvak and Pesakrit. Although King Paranjan was a ruler of the citizens who possessed eyes, he unfortunately used to associate with these blind men. Accompanied by them, he used to go here and there and perform various activities. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This is a reference to the arms and legs of the living entity. The two legs do not speak, and they are blind. If a person simply trusts his legs to take him walking, he's likely to fall into a hole or bump into something. Thus led by the blind legs, one's life may be placed in jeopardy. Of the senses that are working, the hands and legs are very important, but they have no eyes to see. This means that the hands and legs, there are no holes. In the head, there are many holes, two eyes, two nostrils, two ears, and one mouth. But lower down, in the arms and legs, there are no holes. Consequently, the arms and legs have been described as andha, blind. Although the living entity has many holes in his body, he nonetheless has to work with his hands and arms. Although the living entity is the master of many other senses, when he has to go somewhere, or do something, or touch something, he has to use his blind legs and hands. So, there's a shortcoming in the there in the arms and legs. They cannot see on their own. Now the hands do see after a fashion, and blind people can feel the contours of a face. And they can see, they get some impression of what is the thing they're touching. When I was a boy, I saw a picture of Helen Keller, she was an old lady then, with President Eisenhower. And she was famous, she was a very famous blind, deaf, mute, who overcame great trials to educate herself. And she was, despite her limitations, a brilliant person. She wrote many books. And so, she was with President Eisenhower and was touching his face. The President of the United States, usually you don't go up and touch his face, but for her, they made an exception because this is the way she could understand what he looked like. On the hands of a musician also, on a piano keyboard, we see there's a feeling of touch. There's an incredible, hyper-developed sense of touch. We have some famous musicians. Two of them come to mind. It's Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder. Both of them blind, but excellent piano players. Just incredible piano players. And move their hands up like this and come down in the right place and so forth. Just they had a feeling. So their arms and hands were fingers and so forth, all coordinated. So in a sense, they could see. It's said that when the sense of sight is lost, the hearing becomes more developed. So we don't see Krishna directly, but because we have this hearing sense, we can perceive Krishna, what he looks like, what he's about, how he acts, so many different things we can understand by the hearing process. But of course, the arms and legs, they don't have any hearing capacity either. They don't have any arms, or they don't have any ears. And so, their sensitivity is limited, even though it may be very interesting and very developed. And my first wife was an accomplished violinist. She held her violin under her chin like this. And with the other arm out like this, she held a bow. And she looked very awkward, but she had a great deal of control of the bow and how it used to strike the strings, and she could make many lovely sounds from her instrument. But the arms and hands are meant for service. Unless engaged by the mind in Krishna service, their existence is pointless. Unfortunately, my wife couldn't see offering her talents to Krishna. She did not become a devotee. The arms and hands may make so many wonderful things. They may make music, art, foodstuffs, beautiful buildings. But all these things are all simply distractions from the purpose of life if they're not used in Krishna's devotional service. Our blind legs, too, can become Krishna conscious if engaged in Krishna's service. If they bring us to the temple so that we can hear the glories of the Lord sung in kirtan and spoken in classes. One who does not use his legs for this purpose is said to be no better than a tree. What is that verse exactly? Do you remember? There's a thing that Prabhupada quotes. At any rate, this purport reminds me of the Vanashram system. And the legs are the Sudras, the working class of men, and the arms are the Kshatriyas. Now both of these classes of men, they're both blind unless they have the head or the Brahminical class to guide them. The head is the Brahminical class of men who see the proper use of human life and direct the arms and legs accordingly. How many times have we heard that? How many times have we heard that? Many, many times. But eventually we will be, we'll have to take it to heart. And as Brahmins, because that is our objective here, to become Brahminical, act as Brahmins, we have to accept our role as teachers. Janakapandit is an example of such a Brahmin. He approached a king whose kingdom was in great jeopardy and told him what to do, stabilize the kingdom, act as the prime minister, until the king doubted his advice. And then Janaka just left the king. And what happened to the king? Anyone remember? I think he lost his kingdom. He refused to listen. He doubted what the Brahmin was saying, and as a result, catastrophe. Anyway, Brahmins are renunciates. They don't care for profit, adoration, and distinctions. Political posts, power, control, they mean nothing to them personally. Chanaka was living in a little hut outside the palace gates. He just had a little hut. He wasn't concerned with a big room. No, I need a bigger room. I need a corner room so I have windows on two sides. No, he wasn't concerned with that. He was simply concerned, how can I serve? He saw, when he helped this king, the opportunity to establish religious principles in the kingdom. The king was being attacked by someone who was not so religious. So Janaka helped the king. But if the king didn't want to take his advice, then the Brahmin is renounced. Okay, I'm not here to waste my time. I'm not here to beg you, I'm here to tell you. That position of humility and assertion, sometimes difficult for us to comprehend, put those two together. When someone is humble, but yet he asserts himself, it's difficult sometimes to appreciate. If a Brahmin assumes a post as a prime minister or a manager, it is only to be of service. If you see a leader in it for the take, say in America, he's on the take, he's getting something, he's getting some bribes, he's getting this, that, or the other. He's trying for profit, adoration, position. You know that this person is not a Brahmin. That's why we value the order of sannyas. It is ideally a very selfless position. Sadly, because we desperately need such teachers by example, acharyas, sannyasis, we see it's sometimes impossible for a devotee to maintain a position as a sannyasi. At that time, one's honest renunciation of the renounced order is in order. We have no right to criticize, but while in the position, one should actually be renounced. What's the value of a pretender's bad example? Simply an imposition on society, a misleader causing chaos. Srila Prabhupada said, it's better a sincere sweeper in the street than a charlatan religionist. So the head must be clear, the head must be fixed in knowledge, or the blind legs will simply run off with it. People often say when they commit some crime, my senses got the better of me. They left their intelligence behind. They left their vision behind. They did so many. They stopped hearing good advice, and they let their senses go off with them. Ravana is a good example of this. His desire to touch Sita, to enjoy Sita in different ways, was his downfall. So many people were giving him advice, so many people counseling him, give this woman up, give it back to her lawful husband. But he could not take this advice. As a result, he was killed. Well, the sudra's position, and today, if we return to the sudras, the legs of the society, and return to that analogy, we see that in countries around the world, great interest of politicians now, there's a great interest in the opinion of the blind legs. The sudra's opinion is catered to, it's pondered to get more votes from the ignorant mass of people. In some places, this is not the case, and we see repression of the legs. Start killing the legs. It's interesting what's going on in so many different places today. But the first rule of political science is that the mass is ignorant. The mass of people are ignorant. They do not know what is best. They do not know what is coming to them after this life. They do not know what thing to do in the next life or in the next moment. They have to be told. The sudras comprise about 80% of the population. Of course, there's several different ideas about this, but the sudras are 80%, the vaishyas are 10%, the kshatriyas are about 6%, and the brahmins about 4%, or 3%, 7%, something like that. So like that, so many different necessities are there to keep the ignorant people in a position that's beneficial for them, that's actually beneficial for them. Not to keep them chained to their ignorance, but to actually elevate them and give them instruction. The instruction that a person, a devotee, gives to an ignorant person, a devotee is a very elevated, intelligent person, but when he gives instruction to an ignorant person, that person may not take it. He may not have his senses under control well enough to act on those instructions. But still, the penetration is there. The soul is hearing. And a desire can be instilled when you preach to an ignorant person for something higher. He may not intellectually understand what you're saying or what you mean or what the consequences of his current lifestyle may be. But he gets a glimmer that someone cares for him and wants to give him something more than what he has. And this respect that's generated from that exchange of the devotee with the ignorant person, there's a respect that's generated from that that leads to that ignorant person's elevation eventually. It may take a long time. But it's just, Prabhupada uses that example that I found very interesting, that you become Krishna conscious by degrees, 1%, 2%, 5%, 10%, etc. You become by degrees. And whatever you have, you never lose. So whatever you give to some person, although it may seem that they are not interested or they're not going to take to it or they have no volition to go in the direction of Krishna consciousness, that is their foundation. They are getting a glimpse into something higher than what they're experiencing. They're getting a knowledge of spiritual reality, and that is invaluable. So we should always feel that it's never, that it's useless or improper or just basically of no avail to preach to people. So people think, with their limited knowledge of events, that they are well informed and highly educated. They have highly educated opinions. So Prabhupada said, capitalize on this. You go, my dear sir, you are so elevated, you are so intelligent, you understand this. Now please forget everything and just become Krishna conscious. Just take to the chanting of these names. Just take to the reading of the Bhagavatam. People have little brains. I have a very little brain, I know. It's astounding how small my brain is. When I compare myself to some of the devotees I see who have memorized so many slokas and know the books back and forth, I'm very much humbled and appreciative of how small my brain is. So people have little brains, but they're satisfied with pinches of information, and they're easily lied to. People are very easily manipulated and lied to. But in Krishna consciousness, we can actually give them something that's valuable, something that's eternal. If I give you a piece of gold, how long will you be able to hold on to it or keep it? You may have to exchange it sometime for food or whatever, some needs, medicine, whatever. But if I give you Krishna consciousness, you never lose it. You don't need a pocket or a safe to put it in. It's there for you. It's there in your soul, and you'll never lose it. So we take advantage. We're here in this very comfortable position. A very comfortable position with the opportunity to just luxuriate, we can say. Actually, it's a luxuriate. That means generally a very Epicurean term, a very sensual term. But we can luxuriate in Krishna consciousness here in Mayapur. I wrote a short note to a friend this morning and said, I'm so happy to be here in Mayapur. It's so wonderful, so incredible. I'm getting a lot of work done with the writing I'm trying to do, and I'm just feeling so satisfied. So we can luxuriate in the holy dham if we're taking up Krishna conscious activities. It's very, 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 very exciting. This is a place of refreshment. Prabhupada said devotees come here and they refresh and they go back to the battlefield. So, I went on and on here about the limitations of the sudras, the blind legs. So unless we help these blind people, these blind legs and arms, they're destined to rot in illusion forever. It's our responsibility. If you see someone drowning, it's your responsibility to try to save them. Some way or shape, form, you get a rope, or you take off a shirt and throw the shirt to them. Try to get them out of the water. If you can't swim yourself, if you can't do the great deed of going in and actually plucking them out of the water, some way or another you try to get some help, get a stick, get something. There's a group of people, you form a chain of people holding on to each other and go out for that person. So somehow or another we have to destroy their illusion and bring them to Krishna consciousness. We who supposedly can see, we have this obligation to give the vision of perfect future that awaits us in Krishna's association to everyone as best we can. So that's all I have on my notes, and I thank you very much for your attention. Sorry that I had to read all these things, but in reviewing the text, a lot of things came to my mind. And I didn't want to forget, which I would normally do if I didn't have a notes. 17 pages of notes remain. Well, of course, it's big type, but if there's any questions or comments, I'm ready to field all hardballs. Yes, Maharaji.
Hare Krishna. You spoke about the non-devotee and then he gets respect for the devotee. But I was wondering how he gets respect, because normally the non-devotee doesn't normally respect the devotee.
Well, that's I think if people are fair, if they have some sense of fairness, you know, in other words, they're not the kind of people that just go around beating up people or something, but they actually have a favor of fair play. If a devotee approaches them and they detect the sincerity of that devotee in his presentation, even his presentation may not be so expert, but his sincerity is there, that people will develop respect. So it behooves a devotee to act in a gentlemanly or ladylike way. It's very important not to be pressing or pushing or insisting, but just make your presentation. If we do that, we will generally get respect, just as when you're passing someone and you nod. It's just a sign of respect. I acknowledge your presence. So like this, any person that you actually approach and directly talk with, they're going to some extent or another appreciate you. They may even degrade you or talk down to you or insult you, but they come away quite often they come away with a feeling, you know, that person has something to offer. He's not a bad person. And just that much advancement can counteract all of the other nonsense they did. There's a very funny cartoon that comes to my mind about in America. They have two sides of the country, the East Coast and the West Coast. So this one man, these two men are coming together on the East Coast. They're walking like this. And what they say, "Hi, how are you? Nice to see you. Good to see you." And then as they go past each other, they say, "That guy, I don't like that guy. What a jerk." And that was the West Coast. That was California. In the East Coast, they're coming together and they're growling at each other. That's you. Then when they get past it, "That's a nice guy. He's okay." Like that. Human nature it changes so rapidly, you know. We have a mood and then we have a different mood based on how we receive their questions, comments, and so forth. They will perceive us. One man was on Sankirtan, one devotee was on Sankirtan once, and a man told him something I thought was very profound. He said, "I don't know your philosophy. You know, I don't know anything about your philosophy, but I know how your presence here affects me." So like that, if you're a lady or a gentleman and you present yourself in a humble sort of way, you can't miss. Some of the biggest book distributors, we used to have so many different types of book distributors, very aggressive people and so forth. But some of the biggest book distributors, the ones that lasted and got out millions of books over 20, 30 years, those people always took a humble position. Vaisheshika, if you've ever met him or you've seen him, you know, as he presents Krishna consciousness, he's just super humble, very enthusiastic, and you sense when he comes up to you, he's ready for you to speak and tell him something. He's ready to hear you. Now he's got it down. He won't spend hours listening to some rap or anything, but he can understand exactly what people are saying, and he can draw them out because of his receptive attitude to them just coming up. So that's an important issue for us all as we present ourselves in the society of non-devotees and the society of devotees. This key to all success is humility. I had, in the course of my life, met a couple of people who were very, very well placed in business, very, very, you know, multimillionaires and so forth. And I always found that they were very humble people. You know, that's not always the case, but people that I met were humble. They actually had an appreciation of their good fortune. So we should also have that appreciation of our good fortune and not be arrogant because we're devotees, not be puffed up smarta brahmins because we know so many things, but be willing to give Krishna consciousness to people in a way that they can take it. Okay. I guess, we'll do all.
Hare Krishna. Use the word volition, like people choosing, you know, to make a choice. Quite often, when we present Krishna consciousness, how to present that without pride? Because you know, Lord Chaitanya says, you know, this is the only way, the only way, the only way. If you confront people with that approach, quite often they find an arrogance in that Hare Krishnas have the only way.
So yeah, that's a fact. The Christians come on with Jesus is the only way and you're going to hell. It's just not a very palatable way of approaching someone. It's actually, they're in a position, they're taking a position that I can put you in hell if you don't accept Jesus. They're really ready to slam you. So we say, yes, this is the only way, this is the only way. This chanting of the holy names. If you just say this is the only way, this is the only way, they don't know what you're talking about. You have to explain the chanting of the holy names, the benefits, the access to Krishna that's gained by the chanting. We can use a scientific example if you want. I always like this example. Everything is made of sound. Essentially, if we project the right sound vibration into something, you can just explode it. You know? Everything is made of sound in the material world. And that's what it is. It's a sound vibration. It's a vibration. So if you have the vibration, the key to the spiritual world, this Hare Krishna mantra, you can go there. It opens the door to the spiritual world, it's chanting. And we start to see into that spiritual world first through the books, you know, and the paintings and the discussions, the hearing and so forth, the process is there. But basically we start to see in the spiritual world through the potency of this chanting, of reciting this sound vibration. And the sound vibration is not just some blah, 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 blah. It's Hare Krishna, let me serve Krishna. Let me go back to the spiritual world and serve Krishna. Let me return to Krishna. This is what it means. So if that's explained, then later on you can tell them this is the only way, it's the only way. It's the only way that I see, you know, we can say that. This is the only way I can see. But to quote that, it's the only way, without some reference, it's useless. Yeah. It's useless. Just to tell someone you're in sin, you're living in sin, you know, it's useless unless you tell them what is proper living, how to properly live. So that's the essential thing in preaching. Again, maintain that humble position and make sure that what you tell them is humble. Yeah. And it's educational, it's full knowledge. And then, even so, Lord Chaitanya is saying this, we don't have to insist on anything when we're preaching. We don't have to insist that, okay, immediately you pay obeisances and, you know, start chanting 16 rounds. We don't insist on any of those things. We gently bring it in. Gently bring it in. So, thank you very much. Glory to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki.